Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure and Free Speech and Election Law Practice Groups. It was recorded on Tuesday, April 22, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our topic is the Susan B. Anthony List case, argued this morning in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear today from returning presenter and expert John Malcolm. I'm going to give him only a brief introduction, so we'll get right to the substance and right to the case. John G. Malcolm is Director and Ed Gilbertson and Sherry Lindberg Gilbertson Senior Legal Fellow, the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation right here in Washington, D.C. John, we're happy to have you back. Please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Yeah, thank you, Dean. I'm delighted to be back. Well, today, as Dean said, the court heard oral argument in Susan B. Anthony List versus Dry House, which is a case involving a constitutional challenge to an Ohio law that makes it a crime during a political campaign to make a false statement about the voting record of a candidate or public official, or to disseminate a false statement about a candidate, either knowing it's false or making the statement with reckless disregard for the truth, with the goal of electing or defeating a candidate. A first violation of the statute is a first-degree misdemeanor punishable by up to 6 months' imprisonment and a fine of up to $5,000. A second violation results in disenfranchisement. Under the law, a person can be subject to criminal sanctions if five things occur. The first is if someone, and that can be anyone, this is a private attorney's general type statute, if someone files a complaint with the Ohio Election Commission, which is an independent agency charged with enforcing the state's campaign finance laws. Two, a panel of the commission convenes a hearing and determines that probable cause exists to believe that a violation of the law has occurred and then refers to the matter to the full seven-member commission. Third, the full commission determines that there is clear and convincing evidence that a violation has occurred and refers the matter to a prosecutor. Fourth, the prosecutor decides to press the charges. And fifth, the defendant is convicted of violating the statute. The dispute in this case arose during the 2010 re-election campaign of Ohio Democratic Congressman Stephen Dryhouse. The Susan B. Anthony List, or SBA List, is a pro-life advocacy organization, and it announced its intention to post a billboard advertisement in Dryhouse's district saying that his vote for the Affordable Care Act was a vote for taxpayer-funded abortions. The billboard company refused to post the ad when Dryhouse's lawyers wrote a letter threatening legal action. Dryhouse also filed a complaint with the Ohio Elections Commission. By a party line vote of 2-1, a panel of the commission found probable cause that the proposed ad violated the law and referred the matter to the full commission for a hearing. At that point, SBA List filed suit in federal district court to block both the commission hearing and the enforcement of the law. The district court declined to stop the commission hearing, but the parties agreed to put off the hearing until after the election. When Dryhouse lost his re-election effort, the commission dropped the matter. Susan B. Anthony List, however, amended its complaint to contend that its speech had been chilled by the Ohio law and the commission's proceedings. SBA List also alleged that in upcoming elections, it planned to characterize any candidate who voted for the Affordable Care Act as having supported taxpayer-funded abortions, a statement which it maintains is true, but which could well subject it to prosecution based on the Ohio Election Commission's prior finding of probable cause to believe that the statement was false. A second nonprofit group, the Coalition Opposed to Additional Spending and Taxes, or COAST, also filed suit, claiming that its speech had been chilled because it wanted to run a similar advertisement, but that it didn't do so because of the Ohio law and because of the commission's findings of probable cause against SBA List. District court consolidated the cases and then dismissed them on ripeness grounds. The Sixth Circuit affirmed the district court, finding that as to SBA List, there was no commission action pending and no objective fear of a future enforcement action against the group. They also said that SBA List did not face a credible threat of prosecution and noted that even if someone had filed a complaint, and even if there was a probable cause finding by a panel of the commission, that just began the process, which may or may not at the end of the day result in a criminal violation and infraction. The court also noted that under normal circumstances, in order to mount a pre-enforcement challenge, a group has to announce its intention to violate the statute, but that in this case, SBA List had not done so because it didn't claim that it was going to violate the statute because it believes that the statements that it wants to make are in fact true. With respect to Coast, the Sixth Circuit held that its claims were even more speculative because that group was never even threatened with the commission action. The issue before the Supreme Court is the ripeness question, whether someone has to be prosecuted for violating the law before challenging it, or whether a challenger can bring a free enforcement challenge to the law based on a claim that his speech was chilled by the existence of the law. Assuming that the court finds that the case is ripe for resolution, the second issue would be whether or not the law violates the First Amendment. However, the parties have not explicitly asked the justices to rule on that issue, so it's unlikely that they will do so. Although, as I will discuss, the merits of the law as to whether or not it is constitutional clearly played a role in today's discussion. In its brief to the Supreme Court, SBA List argues that the Sixth Circuit erred by holding that a party has to demonstrate a likelihood that he would be successfully prosecuted under the law before he can mount a pre-enforcement challenge. SBA List points out that several other circuits have held that a challenger wishing to mount a pre-enforcement challenge to a speech suppressive law may do so unless the law is an old one that has fallen into disuse, or prosecutors have made a firm commitment not to enforce the law against the would-be challenger. SBA List also argues that the Sixth Circuit erred when it held that SBA List could not amount a pre-enforcement challenge to a law prescribing false political speech if the organization continues to maintain that the statements it wishes to make are true. SBA List notes that the Eighth Circuit, for instance, has held that such a pre-enforcement challenge would still be proper if others who enforce the law could believe that the proposed statements are false and would violate the law, as the Ohio Election Commission clearly did in this case. SBA List also argues that the Supreme Court recently, most notably in the Alvarez case, that was the Medal of Honor case, has held that even false statements can receive First Amendment protection, and that, as even the dissenters in Alvarez appeared to recognize, when it comes to matters of public concern, laws that put government officials in the business of deciding what is truth and what is false, or as Mike Carvin referred to in today's arguments, a truth commission, would put government officials in the business of deciding what is true, that such a law that puts government officials in the business of deciding what's true and what's false could very easily be abused both by commissioners and by complainants, and that in turn would chill speech, even truthful speech, and therefore would run afoul of the First Amendment. SBA List argues that its speech was chilled in that it wanted to spread its message while the OEC charges were pending against it, but that it was reluctant to do so, because of the findings. And Coase clearly says that it didn't engage in the speech because of the OEC's findings. Now, before discussing today's oral argument, it's worth mentioning that there were some very unusual amicus briefs filed before the Supreme Court for this case. For instance, the court received not one, but two briefs from the state of Ohio, one arguing in favor of affirming the Sixth Circuit, and the other sort of arguing against it, something which is incredibly rare, but by the way is not unprecedented. In one brief filed by the Ohio Solicitor General, Eric Murphy, who argued the case today, the state argued that the Sixth Circuit was correct in ruling that the case was not ripe, that the court should refrain from reviewing challenges to state laws in the absence of a credible threat of impending legal harm, and that to do otherwise would be an unwise and unconstitutional watering down of Article III's case or controversies requirement. In a separate brief filed by Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine through pro bono counsel, he argued that the Ohio law could indeed have a chilling effect on protected speech immediately before elections that might violate the First Amendment. Although DeWine argues that the likelihood of being prosecuted for making a false statement in connection with the political campaign is remote, quote, the impact of a state agency declaring that it has found probable cause that an individual has made a false statement, often described in the press as lied, in the immediate run-up to an election can be profound, And that, quote, candidates who find their campaigns disrupted in the final days, even for what eventually proved to be true statements, have no effective relief. The damage is done. They also argue that speakers who make statements, even true ones, during the late stages of a political campaign may end up having to devote significant amounts of time, effort, and money defending themselves before the Ohio Election Commission, which has no system as part of the law to weed out frivolous complaints, and that the mere existence of the prospect of being hauled before the OEC may lead some speakers to self-censor or otherwise remain silent. There was a highly amusing brief that was filed on behalf of the Cato Institute by Ilya Shapiro and also by well-known satirist P.J. O'Rourke. The crux of that brief is that the government does a very poor job of deciding what is true, what is false, and what is merely truthy, and that political falsehoods, whether broken campaign promises or disparaging comments about opponents, are, quote, the cornerstones of American democracy. The brief argues, quote, in modern times, truthiness, a truth asserted from the gut or because it feels right, without regard to evidence or logic, is also a key part of political discourse. It is difficult to imagine life without it, and our political discourse is weakened by Orwellian laws that try to prohibit it. The brief continues, quote, where would we be without the knowledge that Democrats are pinko communist flag burners who want to tax churches and use the money to fund abortions so they can use the fetal stem cells to create pot-smoking lesbian ATF agents who will steal all of the guns and invite the UN to take over America? Voters have to decide whether we'd be better off electing Republicans, those hateful assault weapon-wielding maniacs who believe that George Washington and Jesus Christ incorporated the nation after a Gettysburg reenactment, and that the only thing wrong with the death penalty is that it isn't administered quickly enough to secularist humanist professors of Chicano studies. With respect to the particular statements involved in the case, the Cato brief said the following. Dryhouse voted for Obamacare, which the Susan B. Anthony list said is the equivalent to voting for taxpayer-funded abortion. Amici are unsure how true the allegation is, given that the health care law seems to change daily, but it certainly isn't as truthy as calling a mandate a tax. The Department of Justice, by the way, and the ACLU also weighed in, agreeing that at least some portions of the lawsuit are ripe and ought to be considered by the court. I think it is safe to say, I'll sort of cut to the chase with respect to today's oral argument and then go into a little bit of the back and forth. I think it is fairly safe to say that SBA List is highly likely to win this case and that the case will be remanded for a hearing as to whether or not the Ohio law is facially unconstitutional, although I would not be at all surprised if the Supreme Court does not add all kinds of dictum pointing out that in their belief the law is highly likely to be unconstitutional. So Mike Carvin of Jones Day was arguing the case on behalf of SBA List. He received a couple of questions at the very beginning from Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg, who were saying, look, doesn't this really seem too speculative? Isn't this a little bit like the Clapper decision where maybe you'll be harmed, but it's impossible to say, and it's well down the road? And Mr. Carvin said that that was certainly not the case, that Dryhouse has certainly demonstrated a willingness to fight as hard as possible. Other congressional candidates or their supporters certainly would do the same, that in this case there had been a finding of probable cause, and that Coast also would have standing to challenge the law because it had clearly been chilled because it wanted to make the same statements but chose not to do so only because of the finding by the OEC commission. There were some questions from Justice Scalia. He asked whether or not Carvin was only asking the court to resolve the standing issue or whether it also wanted the court to rule on the constitutionality of false statements. Mr. Carvin said, look, the SBA list clearly believes that the law is facially unconstitutional, but that the court really only needed to resolve the standing issue. And they said that if they did not find standing or ripeness, that such laws would be very, very difficult to challenge in the absence of a prosecution, even though there could be lots of chilling effect. He referred to election speech as being at the core of the First Amendment, but as speech that has what he referred to as a short shelf life, And by that, he meant that more than 60 days out before an election, no one really cares about political speech because voters are not paying attention. And then after an election, no one really cares because the election is over. So you don't really have a ripeness issue more than 60 days out because no one's going to care to challenge the speech. And afterwards, it's highly unlikely that people will continue to challenge the speech. They'll likely drop the matter. But that in the meantime, you would have an awful lot of core First Amendment speech that had been chilled. Sotomayor said, look, was this really a credible threat? Because in this case, the remarks were just made against Dry House, and Dry House lost his election. And, you know, Mike Carbon pointed out that this by no means is a candidate-specific matter. There was a previous Supreme Court case called Golden, in which there had been statements made about another candidate who had since become a judge and was never going to run for election again. The statements were very candidate-specific, and the court had held under those circumstances that there was no credible threat of prosecution for a false statements law. Here, Carbon said this is completely different, that this is going to apply to anybody who voted in favor of the Affordable Care Act, and that there were lots of congressmen running for re-election in 2014, and SBA list was itching to make similar types of statements. Justice Ginsburg asked whether this was really a question of standing or a question of ripeness. Mr. Carbon said, look, that the Sixth Circuit talked about it in terms of ripeness, but that in this kind of context, quote, they are essentially coextensive, and that there really wasn't much of a difference between standing and ripeness. He also pointed out that it's not just the threat of prosecution that would create standing, but that it is the prospect of being hauled before the Ohio Election Commission and having to spend time, effort, and money going through this onerous process, and that in and of itself might be enough. Assistant Solicitor General Eric Fagan argued on behalf of the United States. He pointed out that in his view that a finding of probable cause by a panel of the commission and an expressed desire by Susan B. Anthony List to repeat these statements made the case ripe for resolution. He actually got peppered with a whole bunch of questions about whether or not you even needed to have a finding of probable cause. His initial response was that before there was a finding of probable cause by the commission, that it would be too speculative, and so that there would not be standing. And Justice Kagan then hit him with a whole series of questions about saying, well, what if the candidate wrote a letter to SBA List and to lots of vendors who said, gee, if you make this statement, we will then file with the OEC. Fagan then said that that might be good enough because that would constitute a credible threat of some kind of enforcement action. Kagan then took it to the next step and said, well, what if you just know that this person's going to have a lot of supporters and that one of those supporters is highly likely to go to the Ohio Election Commission if SBA List makes this statement. And Fagan then retreated a little bit further and said that perhaps because this is a private attorney's general statute in which any supporter can allege a false statement by somebody who supports the opposition, that might constitute a credible threat. Justice Ginsburg asked whether Coast, who had after all not been hauled before the OEC, whether they had standing. Fagan said yes, because the speech that they wanted to assert was identical to the speech that SBA List wanted to make, and that there had been this finding of probable cause, so their speech was chilled. Justice Alito asked, by the way, how many of these cases have been filed before the Ohio Election Commission. Fagan said it was his understanding that over the last few years that over 500, apparently Ohio is incredibly active in terms of its Ohio Election Commission, way more than any other state, that about 500 of these challenges had been filed before the Ohio Election Commission. The Solicitor General, Eric Murphy, who was up next, later also supplemented that information and said that out of those 500, five cases had been referred for criminal prosecution, resulting in three pleas. So Eric Murphy, the Solicitor General of Ohio, stood up to argue that there was no credible threat of prosecution here, and that probable cause finding was really not a finding that this speech was criminal. It was only enough to make a referral to the full commission. He was peppered. He was peppered by Roberts, who would say, you know, gee, does it require a prosecution before somebody can have this sort of thing? Scalia said, look, it doesn't really matter about prosecutions, that this is a matter of being dragged into an Ohio Election Commission at a very, very critical time in the election process. Scalia also said, look, that this wasn't dry house specific, that this would go to any candidate who voted in favor of the Affordable Care Act, and that this was highly likely to repeat itself. Breyer and Kennedy weighed in about the chilling effect that a potential OEC proceeding would have, to which Murphy gave no ground. He said that just being chilled was not enough, that there had to be a threatable threat of prosecution. The justices were having none of it at all. Kagan and Ginsburg went further, and they both sat there and said, look, isn't defining a probable cause, which to lawyers may be understood to mean that this is just some preliminary finding that takes you to the next step in the process, but that to the general public, probable cause translates into, quote, probably lied. And that people would be afraid of such a finding, that their speech had probably was a probable lie and could adversely affect the candidate whom they supported. That could have a chilling effect. You know, I think it is they then got around to Murphy basically assuming that he had had lost and said, look, if the case gets remanded, if we find against you and find that there was standing, how quickly could we get this issue decided? Because there's, after all, an election just around the corner. And Murphy hemmed and hawed at that. He finally sat there and said, well, one thing that the trial court could do would be to certify the question to the Ohio Supreme Court, which might rule on an expedited basis. Robert said, yes, well, that would indeed speed up the process some, which caused an outbreak of laughter in the courtroom. Scalia and Alito, Justice Scalia and Alito, said, look, how do you square your position with Alvarez with respect to false statements and the constitutionality of false statements? Murphy said that false statements in an election context are somewhat different, and that the state has a heightened interest, a more compelling interest to prevent false statements because of the potential impact on elections. When asked by Sotomayor if he could point to instances in which false statements had in fact impacted the election, he could not, and pointed just to their potential. Carvin had previously said, by the way, that because this was an election context and more subject to abuse, that it deserved more First Amendment protection than a guy like Alvarez, who lied about being a Medal of Honor winner. There were certain moments of levity in the courtroom. For instance, at one point, when Murphy was saying that this was candidate specific and that Dry House had lost his election and that he was now a director of a component of the Peace Corps in Africa, Justice Scalia said, boy, he really lost, didn't he? And that caused an outbreak of laughter in the courtroom. But I think it is very, very safe to say that SBA's case will be able to continue in the lower court, that they are highly likely to prevail, possibly unanimously, but that remains to be seen. With that, I'll open it up to questions.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Malcolm. We'll all hear a prompt momentarily that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for John Malcolm, our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see who might ring in with a question, let me make our commercial announcement here. The Federalist Society's second annual Executive Branch Review Conference is scheduled for May 7th at the Mayflower Hotel here in Washington, D.C. It's a day-long event with a terrific slate of panelists and speakers and topics. CLE is available, so we encourage even out-of-town folks to consider attending. It's featured on the front page of the Federalist Society's website, so I urge you to take a look. In terms of upcoming schedule for Teleform conference calls, tomorrow at 2 p.m. we'll be talking about the Argentina bond case heard yesterday in the U.S. Supreme Court. That concerns sovereign nation defaulting on its debt and the limits of discovery for aggrieved bondholders. And Thursday at noon, we'll be talking about encryption. Friday at noon, we'll be talking about mental capacity and capital punishment. Today, of course, we're talking to John Malcolm. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Although it's not quite correct that the doctrine of standing originated with Farthingham v. Mellon in 1923, for an originalist perspective on these issues, it's worthwhile pointing out that in the framing generation, any usurpation by Congress, the passage or example of a unconstitutional act, would itself have been considered a violation of everyone's rights and justiciable, even if no one was being prosecuted, even if there was no application of the statute. And this principle would have been accepted as applying to states as well. So we've come a long way, and you might want to comment on whether it might be worthwhile to make some originalist arguments in these cases that would begin to move judicial doctrine back to where its original understanding.
Well, those arguments weren't made in this court. I thought it was very interesting in that Mike Carvin kept saying, look, maybe I win just by the existence of this law. He made it quite clear, by the way, that they had no interest in any kind of a limiting construction of the statute, that they wanted to have a remand. They were going to challenge the statute in its entirety. They weren't interested in any kind of an as-applied challenge. I think that even, although I didn't get a chance to talk to him after the argument, he would be a little bit surprised at people saying that it wasn't even necessary to have a probable cause finding, that just the existence of this law was enough. But as he pointed out at the very beginning, he's, look, my case is even easier because of that finding of probable cause, that makes it beyond peradventure that at least a body of this commission thought that I had, thought that SBA List had committed a crime, and that there was a definite credible threat of prosecution. I mean, I think the justices all came away with the idea that this was a bad law, although, by the way, many states have such laws, some that can result in criminal violations, some that can result only in civil violations, but that there was an awful lot of free speech that was being chilled because people were violating this process in a hyper-partisan fashion.
Once again, we're talking to John Malcolm. If you have a question, our phone lines are wide open now. We don't have any questions pending. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see if others ring in, let me ask, you've mentioned standing and ripeness. Was there any discussion at all about mootness, or is that just off the table because this is something that's going to recur at every election, theoretically?
Well, interesting. The only thing that was discussion about that was Mike said, look, because this has such a short shelf life, that if you don't find ripeness short of a prosecution, that, you know, other than these three cases that resulted in pleas, that there's going to be a lot of speech chilled and very, very little ability to challenge these, since after the election, very few people have the heart or the desire to continue with these proceedings. So he said, look, you can either find that the case is ripe for resolution and that we do have standing, or you can find that we ought to be able to make this argument by referring to the old capable of repetition yet evading review standard to get around the mootness challenge.
Okay. We've got one caller question now. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Leo Dombrowski, society member in Chicago. I may have missed this in your presentation, but I assume there are other states who have similar statutes. How many other states have similar laws, and have there been challenges, either pending or concluded challenges to those statutes?
I forget the precise number, but there are a number of states. It was 20-some-odd states that have similar statutes. I'm not aware of any challenges to any of these other laws. However, I will state that the parties all acknowledged that Ohio, not surprising, I suppose, because it's a battleground state, blows away every other state in terms of the number of actions that are filed challenging the truthness or falsity of statements in an election context. It could be because Ohio, one, it is a battleground state with a highly charged electorate. It could also be because it's essentially a private attorney's general statute. So anybody, it doesn't even have to be somebody from Ohio, can initiate these proceedings before the Ohio Election Commission. It doesn't have to be the commission itself. It doesn't have to be the candidate. Anybody can do it. And also, there is no procedure in the Ohio law for a summary determination of frivolity. So anybody who files the statement, the Ohio Election Commission, you know, creates a panel and a hearing is held. And, of course, anybody who doesn't show up before that panel runs the risk of a default finding or finding a probable cause, which would accomplish the goals of the people who filed the action in the first place, because they want that press statement that the statement that had been run against their candidate was determined by a panel to be false. There are other state statutes, but Ohio, by a dramatic magnitude, takes advantage of this statute by more than any other state.
It's Dean Reuter again. I wonder, beyond the private attorney general aspect, was there anything in the record or any allegations of uneven enforcement of the statute, content-based enforcement or politically motivated enforcement? Did that play into the argument at all?
Well, I don't know about content-based. It just has to do with any, you know, it could be any false statement without any scienter whatsoever about somebody's voting record, or an intentionally false or recklessly made statement with respect to anybody designed to enforce an election. So the content of the statement is going to be political in nature, whether it's been filed by more Republicans against Democratic candidates or vice versa. I don't know, and I don't recall seeing anything in the record about it.
Okay, that's what I was getting at. Got a number of questions pending. Now let's go to our next caller.
This is Matt McReynolds, Pacific Justice Institute. My question is, based on the arguments today and what you have read in the briefs, do you think it more likely that the court is going to stay focused on the political aspects of this particular type of pre-enforcement challenge, or do you see maybe some broader implications for other types of regulatory enforcement action, say, in the realms of professional discipline?
I think it could very well be the latter. When Justice Breyer, for instance, kept talking about the merits of this, Eric Murphy said, look, you really should just stick with the standing issue. You really shouldn't get into the merits, to which he said, well, the merits play into this because there are many, many people, because of the existence of this speech, who feel chilled and will never say anything to begin with. They will self-censor, so that the merits play a role in how this plays out. Obviously, you know, they could talk about the importance of this taking place in a political context where having more speech is perhaps more important, and where there are lots and lots of folks out there who, if somebody actually makes a false statement, can bring that person to account by you know, informing the electorate of the falsity of the statement or contacting pundits like John Stewart or Stephen Colbert. But I think that in general, the idea was if you are facing the threat of something bad happening to you and you really don't have any other way of challenging this, it could have broader application.
All right, two questions pending at this point. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hi, it's David Tryon in Cleveland, and being at the epicenter of many political campaigns, I see an incredible amount of advertising and other statements which anybody could interpret to be lies and subject to this type of enforcement. So I don't see a lot of chilling going on. I see an awful lot of speech going on. On the other hand, I know probably the smaller players, local races and that, there's probably more chilling going on there when there's not so many resources available. But I'm interested to know, other than these two particular groups that were involved, was there much evidence of speech chilling going, you know, put in the record anywhere?
There were an awful lot of amicus briefs filed by Organizations that, for instance, have people who go door to door to proselytize, who were very concerned about regulations of this type and being hauled before commissions to defend themselves. I think it was a real concern about the expense that one would have to go to and to challenge these sorts of laws and the self-censorship that gets involved.
And I think that is very real, especially at the local candidate level, when in the middle of a campaign, people who are only are campaigning for part-time positions could be told that you have to appear, you could have to drive down, take off from your day job and drive down to Columbus, which could be a 2 or 3 hour drive, to
right.
appear before the commission on 2 days' notice.
And no, I think that's right. And I also think, by the way, so at one point Justice Scalia asked Solicitor General Murphy, he said, look, this statement that was involved here about taxpayer-funded abortion, in your opinion, was that a statement of fact or was that an opinion about whether or not the Affordable Care Act does lead to taxpayer-funded abortion? Because, of course, the statement, the probable cause finding by the panel was that this was an objectively false statement of fact. And even Murphy sat there and said, well, if you were asking me, I would have said it was an opinion. So I think there was also it was that aspect of getting government bureaucrats who might well have a dog in the hunt deciding what is truth and what isn't that also reverberated with the justices.
Okay.
Let's take another question.
This is Jack Park. John, you just addressed my last question, which was going to go to the distinction between factual assertions and opinion and the need to protect expressions of opinion.
Right.
So thanks a lot.
All right. We've got one question still pending. If you want to ask a question of John Malcolm, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines will be open after this next question.
You lose him?
Go ahead, caller. We can't hear you. Maybe your phone is on mute.
Maybe I satisfied his question.
I'm sorry. I was on mute. Apologize about that. This is Brian Trapp from Cincinnati. I was hoping you could share your thoughts on one of the questions I thought was a key question from Justice Kagan when she asked when, if ever, the SBA list would actually have standing under Ohio's kind of reading of the law.
Yeah, let me find where I wrote my notes about that. I believe what he kept coming back to was if there was a probable cause determination and the person stated that they were going to have an intention to repeat the same statement. It was obviously not a very satisfactory answer. I don't think.
Well, that's where we are right now.
No, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Okay. So here we go. So Justice Kagan said, so when would Ohio allow a pre-enforcement challenge? And essentially, the Solicitor General said somebody would have to allege that they intended to violate the statute, or there would have to be indicia that there was a very strong likelihood of prosecution. And that was not a satisfying answer to the other justices. It was in fact right after the answer to that question that Justice Breyer's next question was, well, what if you lose and we send this to remand? How quickly can this challenge take place since elections are just around the corner? Which, if I were the Solicitor General, I would not take comfort in that sequencing of questions.
Let me make another call for questions. If you have a question, our lines are wide open now. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Sounds like, John Malcolm, you have satisfied our audience today. let me give you an opportunity to wrap up or express a final thought if you have one.
Well, look, it was an exciting day at the court today. There was a big case involving copyrights and transmissions over the air with Paul Clement arguing the Arrow case. Supreme Court issued a 5-4 decision in a Fourth Amendment case in Avrete, and, of course, a very highly anticipated opinion in Schuette versus Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action.
Did anyone read from the bench on the Schuette case? I'm curious.
Yes, there was a very extended excerpt read, very extended, probably went on for a good 15, 20 minutes from Justice Kennedy, who wrote for the plurality. Scalia did not read anything for his concurrence, nor did Breyer read from his concurrence. And then there was an even longer excerpt, rather impassionately read from by Justice Sotomayor of her dissenting opinion that was joined by Justice Ginsburg. But I feel fairly safe in saying that, at least with respect to SBA list, that there will not be too much doubt as to the likely outcome.
Well, terrific. Let me thank you on behalf of the Federalist Society. Our guest has been John Malcolm of the Heritage Foundation. Many thanks for not only joining us today, but for sitting through the argument this morning, obviously, and giving us your insights. To the audience, thank you as well for dialing in. And a reminder that tomorrow at 2 p.m., we'll be discussing the Argentina bond case, which was heard yesterday in the Supreme Court, as our coverage of Supreme Court cases continues. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.